Yahovu. That's a traditional Nias greeting. Nias, Indonesia. Surfers might recognize that name because of the majestic right-hander that breaks in Legundri Bay on the southern tip of the island. Anthropologists know about Nias because it's one of the last remaining megalithic cultures on Earth. What most people don't know about is the island's dark and dangerous history. Traditions that include headhunting, slavery, black magic, elite bloodlines, and war. My name is Phil Goodrich, and this is A Surfer's Path, Episode 1. In this episode, I'm going to tell you about the early history of Nias Island, about Persian merchants who spread rumors of an island made of gold, populated by headhunters and their beautiful women. I'll tell you about the ruthless Dutch colonizers that tried and failed to control the tribes of southern Nias. The Christian missionaries that arrived were struck down within months by epidemics of malaria, dengue fever, and typhoid, but most of all, fear for their lives. But by far, the most interesting character I'm going to talk about in episode 1 is an Italian anthropologist named Elio Modigliani. In future episodes, I'll tell you the outrageous story of the first surfers to discover and ride the waves of Legundri Bay in 1975. It was the photos from their trip that stupefied my 11-year-old brain and eventually changed the trajectory of my entire life. There's a reoccurring theme for foreigners traveling to Nias. It starts with a desire for adventure, to search for something valuable. Could be gold or slave labor, scientific discoveries, or perfect uncrowded waves. But just like the Nias warriors would travel far outside of their villages to ambush victims and return with severed heads to present to their chief, there's always a price to pay for the status that those trophies bring. And there's always been a huge risk involved when traveling to Nias. The difference between life and death is breath. While we breathe, we exist in this world. When we exhale for the last time, we enter another one. Ono Niha is how pre-Christian Niasians referred to themselves. They believed their original god named Loalangi gave an unborn child in the womb a certain amount of noso, which means breath. This breath, or soul stuff, was returned to Loalangi at the time of death. The amount of breath asked for and received determined the length of a person's life, provided it wasn't cut short by violence or sickness. So they believed that people are composed of a body, boto, breath, noso, and an additional component, shadow, lumo lumo, which becomes spirit, betu, at the time of death. Foreigners that visit Nias nearly always experience something profound. Maybe it's because of the difficulty of getting there. Sometimes it's the shock of their culture or the natural beauty of the island. Regardless of the reason, this experience, like a shadow, follows us home and visits us like a dream spirit. The reason for this podcast and the reason I want to tell you about the history of Nias is because the last 20 years, I've been traveling to this area of the world, and it's had a profound effect on my life. This year, I arrived in March, shortly before Indonesia, like most of the world, closed its doors to tourism. Because of a global pandemic, it allowed me, on a small scale, to imagine what it might have been like before the modern world of science and technology imposed its will onto the mysterious spiritual values of the indigenous people of Nias. I believe that by trying to understand their early traditions and searching for the truth about what happened, it might expose some truth about what our world is experiencing in 2020. In my eyes, there's a war going on between scientific theories and spiritual beliefs. Billionaires, scientists, and politicians are imposing their will onto common people. Decisions are being made for us, and lines are being drawn. I'm not claiming that I have the answers. But I experienced something profound during these last 6 months, and I want to share some things that I studied. Does truth exist beyond what's able to be proven by science or quantified by modern technology? One way to find out is to go on a journey. Look for something valuable and dive in with both feet, fully immersing yourself in another nation's culture. I've never met an anthropologist, but if I was alive in 1886, I would consider Elio Modigliani to be a rock star. The things he was able to accomplish on the island of Nias in just 5 months is staggering, especially considering that for 20 years prior, the tribes of southern Nias were regularly kicking the shit out of Dutch colonists. At that time, the only thing Nias people from the south traded with the outside world was slaves. Whenever the Dutch tried to impose their will, they would be sent back to their warships, carrying their wounded and leaving their dead, and their skulls eventually decorated the meeting halls of the villages. This was the scene on the ground when Modigliani arrived in April of 1886. Modigliani came from a wealthy Italian family. His father was a diplomat and a banker, and he hoped Elio would become a lawyer. But the 20-year-old's true passion was anthropology, and in 1880, curiosity brought him to a cave in Genoa, where he discovered Neolithic remains of exceptional value. This discovery catapulted Elio to fame among the scientific circles of his time. So how did this young rock star anthropologist end up going to Nias? One of the popular scientific theories at that time was called physiognomy. I had never heard of this, so I had to look it up. It's the scientific practice of assessing a person's character or personality from their outer appearance, especially the face. In modern times, physiognomy has been considered a pseudoscience and a basis for scientific racism. But recently, just like most science, they've flip-flopped, and the rise of artificial intelligence and machine learning for facial recognition has brought a revival of interest, and some studies suggest that facial appearances do contain a kernel of truth about a person's personality. Young Elio met the famous anthropologist of his time, and one of them, named Odoardo Beccari, had recently explored Sumatra and had heard the rumors of the headhunters of Nias Island. Their conclusion? What better way to collect human skulls for scientific research than to travel to an island where human heads were considered trophies? A place where chiefs of the villages prominently displayed them under the roofs of their public assembly hall as a symbol of power and wealth. It's difficult to imagine the logic behind this decision. To me, it sounds ridiculously dangerous, especially since Modigliani had never traveled to Asia, was only in his early 20s, and he didn't speak the language. But that's precisely what he did. In between 1883 and 1886, he started preparing for this epic adventure. If this was an 80s movie, this would be the musical montage scene where the hero hones his skills. In Elio's case, he became a pioneer of early photography. He also became a carpenter, gunsmith, bush doctor, taxidermist, and mapmaker. Then he went to Holland to study the archives of the Dutch East Indies Trading Company and their dealings with Indonesia. It was here where he managed to learn Malaysian, which was similar to the language that most of Indonesia spoke, that is, except for the islanders of Nias. In 1885, he left from Naples, sailing to Bombay via the Suez Canal. Then he went overland to Delhi and Calcutta, and then set sail for Singapore, and finally to Java, where he recruited 4 Javanese hunter/trackers. His plan was not only to acquire skulls, but to hunt for animals of every kind, and also insects, birds, and plants, all for scientific purposes. Elio's last stop before Nias was the mainland of southwest Sumatra in the city of Sibolga. It was here he tested his equipment and the skills of his Javanese crew. He also contracted malaria for the first time and became used to the climate. On their way from Sibolga to Nias, a crossing of 80 miles due west, during the night they ran into a powerful storm and it snapped the bowsprit of their boat. A trip that normally took 3 days turned into an 8-day drama. They finally arrived to the island of Nias and the northeast city of Gunung Sitoli on April 22, 1886. It was here the Dutch had established a defensive fort, and the port city already had a diverse population of Malaysians, Chinese, and Indians that enjoyed an exotic and diverse market. The Dutch troops were there to supposedly stop the Achenese pirates and their, quote, illegal slave trade. But in reality, the Dutch just wanted to monopolize that industry of indentured labor. There was also a small group of Protestant missionaries who had tried quite unsuccessfully to preach to the natives of South Nias. They fled for their lives after witnessing one of the many wars between villages that always involved decapitation and the capturing of slaves. Elio had all the proper paperwork from the Dutch commanders in Java, which mostly consisted of letters of introduction, which he gave to the commander of the troops in Gunung Sitoli. That commander already had his hands full between the pirates and the constant wars between the Nias tribes. So he hoped this young, eccentric, and naive Italian would be someone that could be easily controlled and looked after. The letters made it clear that Modigliani's safety was his responsibility, and the commander assumed that Elio and his 4 trackers would safely hunt birds and butterflies around the peaceful hills of Gunung Sitoli. It came as a shock to everyone, the commander, the 4 Javanese trackers, and the missionaries, that Modigliani intended to leave immediately for the south of Nias. It turned out that young Elio wasn't all that naive. Instead of accepting the offer of the commander to use one of his military ships, Modigliani wisely understood that the natives in the south's most common encounters with the Dutch involved armed conflict. He chose instead to rent a beat-up ship with a Malaysian captain. The information he collected from the merchants and missionaries also served him well. It turned out that some of the things that Nias tribes valued the most were quite easy to acquire in Gunung Sitoli. The main currency on the island was tobacco, which Nias people coveted above everything else. So Elio purchased a bale of it, 60 kilos to be exact. Other popular items among the natives were blue Chinese beads, red cotton cloth, and copper wire. Also of vital importance was Modigliani's rifle. It was a Winchester repeat rifle. In 1886, this was futuristic Star Trek technology. It could fire 13 rounds without reloading, and the bullets had unprecedented penetrating power and range. The Dutch, by comparison, were still using muzzle loaders, meaning each shot had to be individually loaded with gunpowder. The Nias villages captured their share of these rifles from the Dutch, but they preferred close combat, guerrilla warfare, and their weapons of choice were spears, shields, and swords. Another substance that saved Modigliani was quinine. It was used by the British military at the time in tonic water, and had had early success in treating malaria. His ability to heal would prove to help Elio because he gained a reputation as a white witch doctor, and rumors spread of his powerful magic. During Modigliani's time, anything that happened in the life of a Nyasian could be explained through a lens of superstition and beliefs in supernatural spirits. There was little effort to understand problems and no faith in their own abilities to solve them. They instead consulted witch doctors, whose advice usually involved pleasing some angry spirit and almost always involved the sacrifice of an animal, and sometimes a human head. Modigliani and his trackers arrived in southern Nias at the Bay of Teluk Dalam in May of 1886. On the beach waiting for him were no less than 100 fierce-looking warriors, fully armed. They were shrieking, dancing, and chanting while waving their weapons. Elio's crew was frozen with fear, but that didn't stop him. He grabbed his rifle, a large bag of tobacco, and two men, and started paddling the dinghy towards shore. Through a translator, he was able to quickly explain to the warriors that he wasn't with the Dutch, and he came in peace and friendship. The warriors surrounded him, but they quickly smelled the tobacco, and he explained that if they would take him to meet the chief, that there was plenty of tobacco to go around. This seemed to do the trick, and they were soon marching up a steep hill with a warrior escort that was rhythmically drumming on their shields and practicing fencing the entire way. Later, he learned from the chief that he was being watched from the village above the whole time. Rumors had already traveled from the north about this eccentric Italian with a powerful rifle. As was the custom, the chief presented Elio with a gift of betel nut, which was chewed similar to chewing tobacco except for the bright red stains it left on their teeth. In exchange, Modigliani passed out generous amounts of his tobacco, which proved to make him extremely popular on this and most other encounters. Fausi Aro was the chief of the village of Bawa Lowalani. He was the tallest man on the island at nearly 6 feet, but it was his brain that gave him the most power. Elio described him as sly and devious, a master of intrigue and diplomacy, a warrior of the mind and tongue, able to play both sides, catering to the Dutch and giving them information about other villages, but then joining in during skirmishes between those villages and the white men. It was in this village that Modigliani was to learn many customs of Nias, participate in the snake dance, and trade a musket rifle for his first 11 human skulls. After a few days, invitations from neighboring villages were arriving daily. Elio decided to head west to a village called Hili Giono. It was there he met the chief Siduho Gio, and he was able to take some of his most memorable and striking photos. After the traditional exchange of gifts, betel nut for tobacco, the chief was eager to learn about Italy and this mysterious white man, and Modigliani was to begin learning more in-depth lessons about the customs and beliefs of the warriors from the south. He was given free rein to walk around the village and to take photos of anything, that is, except for the women. Nias men are fiercely protective of their women still to this day, and there's always been an extremely high dowry price to pay, not only to the bride's family, but to their relatives as well. No young warrior is fit to be married until he brings the severed head of an enemy to the chief. The head is then cleaned and hung in the public meeting hall, called the Osale. One of Modigliani's most chilling photos is the meeting hall of Hili Gio. Kneeling on the ground in front of the building are a dozen warriors staring directly into the camera. There are men of all ages and no one is smiling. The hall sits on stilts and about 4 feet above the ground is a balcony where one warrior is sitting on the floor with his legs dangling through the railing. Above him, hanging from the roof like lanterns, are more than a dozen human skulls, looking casual and ominous at the same time. It's in these meeting halls that all decisions in the villages were made. When to wage war, when to make peace, and also how to hand out revenge or justice. No women or foreigners were allowed in, and only men that had brought the chief ahead were able to attend the meetings and participate in the conversations. Other occasions that required human skulls are a chief's funeral or a ceremonial feast in which the leader wants to increase his status. When the chief builds a new house, a head is required. It's first buried at the base of the ladder to the structure, and then later dug up and hung at the Haut Salet. Modigliani later asked a few warriors to explain why heads were such prized trophies. They believed that all of those killed in this way would serve them as slaves in the afterlife. Owner of the skull becomes owner of the soul of the person killed. Hunting parties were sent on long journeys, seeking out villages that didn't have common ancestors or which they didn't fear revenge. When a warrior returned with heads, they were celebrated for their valor and presented with a coveted Kalabubu necklace. This was a stiff collar made from the dark wood from the nut of a sea palm tree. This wood was rare because that type of palm tree wasn't native to Nias, and it was only found washed up on the beach, and so they believed it was magic and offered extra protection. When Modigliani asked to buy some skulls for his collection, Chief Siduho misunderstood his request. He lowered his voice and explained to Elio that in the morning he would arrange 10 of his most skilled warriors to organize a hunting party, but that Elio would need to negotiate a price directly with those warriors. Modigliani was horrified at the prospect of organizing a murder party for fresh human heads, and quickly explained that he only wanted to buy the skulls that were already hanging in the meeting hall. Like most of Modigliani's interactions with chiefs and warriors, it left them wondering about this man and his intentions. He was unlike other white men. He paid high prices for simple objects like skins and feathers of animals, which had little value. He was a medicine man able to cure fevers. Most importantly, he possessed an incredible rifle, and he was daring enough to venture between villages at war with only a small escort. Elio's next stop was the village of Lagundri. At that time, because of all the fighting with the Dutch and a history of earthquakes and tsunamis, the only resident of the bay was a Chinese merchant that had married a local woman. The merchant seemed desperate for company, and so Elio accepted his offer to stay. It was here he was able to replenish his supply of rice and gain some valuable neutral intel about some more tribes in the south. While Modigliani was staying with the merchant, 8 warriors from the village of Hili Simetano arrived at the cottage to trade some pigs for copper wire to repair and adorn their swords and spears. Elio was aware of this village because they had been one of the fiercest opponents of the Dutch, so he was eager to meet their chief. He passed out generous amounts of tobacco and made a deal for the following day to travel to Hili Simetano and meet the chief. The long journey and torrential rainstorm seemed to be a bad omen, and his companions were unnerved by the steep steps at the entrance of the village. The only sign of life was an enormous blackbird which squawked a cryptic warning. It was at this village that Elio would meet his most formidable rival and break some serious taboos that could have easily cost him and his men their lives. His first mistake came when he refused the offer to stay at the chief's house. The relentless rain had left Elio irritable, and he had previously learned that in order to get any field work done, it was easier to remain autonomous by staying in a private room. He noticed a structure that seemed open and empty and hurried to get out of the rain. He didn't notice the skulls hanging along the back wall, and so he lit a fire and changed out of his wet clothes. When the villagers started to arrive, he noticed their agitation, and a warrior he described as remarkable because of his ugly face and ferocious attitude. This warrior forcefully demanded some tobacco. Modigliani wanted to show that he wasn't intimidated, so he said no and brushed him off. Moments later, he was to find out about both of his mistakes. The chief arrived and explained that the structure he decided to invade was the temporary osale, or meeting hall, of Hilly Simitano. No one was to sleep there among the spirits of the dead, especially not a white foreigner. Also, he had refused to give a gift of tobacco to his most powerful warrior, Siwa Sahilu. In the coming days, Elio was to learn that this unattractive warrior was the true chief of the village, and a quite capable physical and mental adversary. What set him apart from most warriors was his curiosity to learn from foreigners. He listened to news from the Achenese slave traders and the Dutch colonialists. He had heard about Modigliani's repeating rifle from the Chinese merchant, and he decided that he must have it. Elio tried to smooth things over with an overly large gift of tobacco and a promise to try and fix Siwa Sahulu's musket rifle. But the days he spent in the village seemed to be doomed from the start. Siwa Sahilu began a covert campaign to make everything difficult for Modigliani and his crew. While pretending to be an ally, he was also spreading rumors about Elio and his crew and their intentions for the wildlife they wanted to collect. The villagers became worried that he was using evil spells to destroy all the animals of the jungle. Siwa Sahilu would visit Modigliani daily and pester him for the shiny brass components on his camera and scientific instruments. This slowly built up the tension. When Elio was unable to repair the warrior's musket, Siwa Sahilu decided that he should have the Remington rifle, and when he learned that the Italian really wanted skulls above all else, he offered to trade them for the mythical gun. Modigliani was growing more frustrated by the day, and when he decided to teach the warrior a lesson, he made his third mistake. He explained to Siwa Sahilu that the rifle would be useless to him because he didn't have the proper ammunition, and that these guns were only made for Modigliani and no one else. Instead of the Winchester, Elio switched rifles to a double-barreled shotgun. When the warrior wasn't looking, he armed both locks and packed both cartridges with a high dose of gunpowder and handed it to the warrior. Elio told him to pull both triggers, knowing the consequences. He didn't grip the rifle properly and received a kickback that knocked him on his ass. Modigliani hoped that this would be a good lesson, but instead the warrior got up and looked at him with raging eyes and stomped away without saying a word. Elio realized that Siwa Sahilu had killed for much lesser insults, and that now he needed to regain his dignity in front of the village. It quickly became apparent that Elio and his men were in deep shit. As a display of force, the warriors began spreading out all of their 70 rifles on the ground in front of their temporary shelter. Elio understood that they needed to flee, but it was approaching nightfall, so he and his men loaded all the guns that they had, and Modigliani unpacked his infernal box, which is what he called a tin of peas that he had filled with dynamite and a fuse. The chief arrived at sundown to humbly suggest that they leave as soon as possible because he wouldn't be able to control Siwa Sahilu and his 3,000 warriors. So Modigliani wisely agreed to leave first thing in the morning. But true to his obsessive nature, he asked the chief for 10 of his men to guide him to the west of the island, to his highest possible point, so he could finish making his map of Nias. Once Siwa Sahilu found out where Elio wanted to go, he realized that the Italian had tipped his hand, so to speak. And now he had some leverage, because he understood that Elio and his men would be helpless to travel towards the untamed southwest. Instead of attacking Modigliani and his men directly during the night, his plan was to scare his Javanese trackers, which would leave Elio alone and vulnerable. During the endless seeming night, they were assaulted by a barrage of psychological warfare in the form of loud war songs and sinister laughter. Many of the warriors were holding torches and smothered themselves in coconut oil. They danced around a fire which cast ominous shadows across their hut and terrified Elio's men. They then began to lob rocks into the meeting hall. When that didn't succeed in flushing out his men, a muzzled and terrified pig was thrust into the room and plowed into the horrified Muslim Javanese. Siwa Sahilu knew that because his crew were Muslims, that this was a huge insult. Modigliani was somehow able to keep his men calm enough to last until the sun rose, and they quickly packed their possessions and quietly made their escape out of the village and back to Ligundri Bay. They left in such a hurry that they couldn't bring all of their luggage, which was counted as a victory for Siwa Sahilu, and their public exit from the village restored a bit of his dignity. When they arrived back at the hut of the Chinese merchant, they were greeted by another group of fierce-looking warriors. Modigliani described them as, quote, "sturdy and full of muscles, with thick black hair. All of them wore the kalabubu and were armed with spears, shields, swords, and knives of every size. They were the warriors from the largest and most warlike village, Bawo Mataloa." He goes on to write, "The leader was speaking with fierce expression, as if he was dictating orders. And further, contrary to their custom, they were not bringing any gift from their chief, but instead, it was their first concern to ask about the Winchester rifle, of which they had heard so much and which their chief would much like to see." This was an obvious red flag to Modigliani, and he had had enough of this kind of village invitation, so he declined. His refusal was basically an insult, and the Chinese merchant later explained that anyone who challenged the chiefs of Bawo Mataloa did not live long enough to boast about it. Most people at this point would have counted their blessings and made their way back to the north of the island in safety. Modigliani's men were also starting to grumble and plot among themselves. But true to his obsessive nature, Elio decided to press on, and he ordered his men to prepare the boat for the trip around to the west side of Nias. He was determined to reach the highest point in the island so he could finish the map and add to his scientific status back in Italy and the rest of the world. What proceeded was much of the same experiences. They would arrive to an unfamiliar village, present the chiefs and warriors with tobacco, and establish some navigational measurements and hunt for more animals and insects to bring home. When the villagers would start to inquire about his Winchester and tensions would rise, they would slip out of the village at just the right time and continue searching for the highest point on the island. After they had pushed through the interior of the island without finding the mythical mountain high point, Elio realized that they had eaten through their supplies and were past the point of turning back to safety of their ship. He decided instead to press on and forward, looping around towards their only choice, back to hilly Simitano and his enemy, Siwa Sahilu. What could have turned into a disaster was once again avoided because of Modigliani's luck. Because they arrived at the opposite entrance of hilly Simitano, the chief and Siwa Sahilu were astonished that in just a few weeks, once again this man and his small group could have made it through the southwest interior of the island, filled with their dangerous enemies. They concluded that this white man must truly possess extraordinary powers above and beyond his famous Winchester. They decided there was no other option but to offer friendship again and hopefully extract knowledge of their enemies and more of Elio's goods. Even more remarkable, Elio was able to mend his rift with Siwa Sahilu, and the warrior finally agreed to trade 15 skulls for one modern breech-loading rifle. Despite Modigliani warning him that once the ammunition cartridges were finished, the gun would be useless, his curiosity and desire to boast about possessing such a new and powerful weapon caused him to ignore the advice. Modigliani was a bit shocked to discover that the 15 skulls he received in trade were only a few weeks old and covered with ants. When his party finally made it back to Lagundri in the hut of the Chinese merchant, they were disappointed to see that their boat hadn't returned from the west side of the island. 10 warriors from the much feared village of Bawa Mataloa were there again negotiating the sale of some pigs. Elio described them as, quote, strong, young, and arrogant, and stared at us in a defiant and determined way. The warriors had not forgotten the insult of refusing their invitation to meet their chief. The warriors left just before sunset, but after a short while, Modigliani realized that they had kidnapped one of his men. The following stressful days were spent waiting for the boat to return and searching unsuccessfully for his man. The messengers they sent to Bawa Mataloa returned with no information, which only made the rest of Elio's men more terrified. They assumed that he was captured for his head or forced into slavery, but the reality turned out to be even worse. He was captured and tortured to death for information about Modigliani. Despite the witch doctor's cruelest tortures, Elio's guide never changed his story. The white man's quest was for a mountain. He traded gunpowder and tobacco for the skins of animals and birds, and was secretly collecting human skulls, defying the very laws of his countrymen. This mystified the chief of Bawa Mataloa. What was the secret to this man's strength and bravery? It was this curiosity that caused him to hesitate in attack, despite having thousands of warriors against only a few men. An impending attack seemed inevitable, but once again, Modigliani had truly amazing good fortune. His boat appeared on the horizon, finally returning from the west side of Nias. They quickly boarded the ship and set sail back to the safety of Ganong Sitoli. They arrived on July 23, 1886, 75 days after leaving. Modigliani and his men were met with a rock star's welcome. Surrounded by a crowd and bombarded with questions, questions about headhunters, wars, trading practices, and most importantly, how the hell did they make it back unscathed? In 146 days, Modigliani and his men were able to gather a formidable collection of natural history and ethnographic specimens. He documented the customs, beliefs, music, dances, and technology of the tribes of Nias. Even wrote a Nias to Italian phrasebook. He was the first white man to explore the interior southwest of the island and took remarkably accurate topographic measurements and produced a map. He took dozens of photos, among the first in history, and developed them on scene, and secretly collected 26 human skulls, an invaluable treasure for the Florence Ethnographic Museum. All of this was accomplished while traveling through a land of the fiercest headhunters who were at war with each other, and yet never had to resort to violence, fire a shot, or even point his Winchester rifle at anyone. When Modigliani first arrived in Nias, he had preconceived opinions about the savage headhunters and their strange spiritual beliefs. In just 5 months, he left the island with a new attitude, and he wrote, "These are indeed gentlemen, regardless of their head cutting." Elio was no doubt completely affected by Nias, and went on to name his first daughter Mohua, a Nias word meaning perfumed one. Perhaps if you're like me, you might be wondering how this young Italian anthropologist was able to pull this off. Why didn't the warriors of southern Nias attack and just take his wealth and weapons like they had done to the Dutch soldiers? It wasn't just dumb luck. Nias culture in general is curious about the outside world. In their imagination and beliefs of the time, only sorcery could be the purpose of collecting all sorts of animals and plants. Photography would have seemed like magic, and the healing powers of quinine combined with his unknown country of origin would have been fascinating to the tribes. Modigliani used psychological warfare, approaching them not as a colonizer or a preacher. He didn't try to impose his views or reform their society. The chiefs could get what they wanted from Elio just by trading for common objects they already had. His space-age weapons and strange clothes kept them fascinated. Even though they could kill him at any moment and seize his wealth, they were content to observe him. In episode 2, I'll tell you about the first surfers to arrive on Nias in 1975. And the stunning similarities of their experience with the tribes of southern Nias. Just like Modigliani, the first surfers were searching for something, a natural resource of which the island had plenty. These Australians' world was also filled with novelties and curiosities for the people of Nias. And once again, curiosity proved to be a powerful and underestimated driver of change. People break down walls and barriers to experience what life is like on the other side of the world. This episode was written, produced, and narrated by me, Phil Goodrich. My resource material relied heavily upon an amazing book. It's called Among the Warriors of Nias by an Italian, Vanni Puccioni. He's an Italian author and worked for an NGO organization on the island of Nias after the catastrophic earthquakes and tsunamis in 2004 and 2005. When he visited the Cultural Museum of Nias, he discovered a book by Modigliani and was blown away by his countrymen's accomplishments. Another reference I used was from a thesis paper by Edward Peake for the Department of Anthropology of the University of London, written in the year 2000. Thanks for listening. I'll include links to the book and all of my resource materials in the show notes. Please hit the subscribe button so you'll be the first to know when episode 2 comes out. And in the future, I'll be talking more about surfing, travel, art, and conspiracy theories. I'll be interviewing some guests as well, so stay tuned. And also, you can follow me on Instagram, feelgoodrichart.